The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
GEICO presents unhelpful home improvement how-tos.
Overhanging trees present a real danger. During high winds, falling branches can damage roofs and windows. So today, I'll show you how to protect your home by wrapping it in bubble packaging. All you need is a staple gun and 142,000 feet of bubble packaging. Let's get started.
You could try to protect your home with bubble packaging, or you could get covered for personal property damage through the GEICO Insurance Agency. Call GEICO and see how affordable homeowners insurance can be.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, talking to Kim Jong-un.
He expressed his eagerness to meet President Trump as soon as possible.
Members of the president's own party react to his new tariffs.
They don't want to see a trade war.
A porn star sues the president.
She wants to be heard, and she wants to tell the public the true facts of what happened here.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Let's get started this weekend with what might be a breakthrough in the campaign to denuclearize North Korea after President Trump accepted an invitation to talk from Kim Jong-un. Here's correspondent Hannah Doba.
It was South Korea that brought the news and invitation from North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to the White House.
He expressed his eagerness to meet President Trump as soon as possible.
President Trump accepted. The offer was extended as a South Korean delegation briefed U.S. officials about its recent sit-down with Pyongyang.
In our meeting, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said he is committed to denuclearization.
South Korea says the face-to-face will take place before the end of May. The White House, though, insists a time and place have yet to be determined. President Trump tweeted in part, "Great progress being made, but sanctions will remain until an agreement is reached, meeting being planned." A senior administration official said any deal with North Korea would have to come with some form of verification of denuclearization. Hannah Doba, CBS News.
Let's shift to tariffs now and talk with CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy. On Thursday, President Trump announced new tariffs on imports of steel and aluminum. Stephen, what are these tariffs?
Well, the tariffs are, as the president said they would be, 10% on aluminum imports, 25% on steel imports. The president says they'll be flexible, and he'll be able to move the rates up and down, he says, and on a country-by-country basis. A key provision affects our closest neighbors and a couple of our biggest trading partners, Canada and Mexico. The tariffs will not immediately go into effect on those countries.
What about Australia?
Well, the president said Australia is a country where the United States happens to have a trade surplus, and that is a longstanding U.S. ally. So perhaps there'll be some exception carved out for Australia. The point that the president was making is he's willing to move a little bit. And that is a direct response to the criticism that has been leveled by House Speaker Paul Ryan and other Republicans who say that it should not be a broad-based tariff affecting every country in the world but Canada and Mexico for now. It should be targeted. And Speaker Ryan says if the problem is China, for instance, flooding the world market with cheap steel, then the moves of this administration should be specifically focused and targeted on China.
And Ryan said in a statement following this announcement that he disagrees with this action, and he, quote, fears its unintended consequences. What are those unintended consequences?
Republicans who have been free traders for decades say that they believe in free trade because they don't want to see a trade war where one nation imposes a protectionist tariff and then the other nations that are affected by that impose additional actions in response. This would tend to affect other manufacturers of products in the United States and farmers. The European Union has threatened retaliatory tariffs affecting American farmers as they try to export things like cranberries and peanut butter and orange juice to the nations of Europe.
White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy on these new controversial U.S. tariffs. Thanks, Stephen.
You bet.
White House Chief Economic Advisor Gary Cohn is the latest top administration official to leave amid a wave of resignations. More from CBS News correspondent Weijia Jiang.
This White House has seen far more turnover than previous administrations.
Believe me,
Everybody wants to work in the White House.
Others aren't so sure.
And I have heard story after story of capable people in the Gary Cohn mold being trying to be recruited by the White House, and no one wants to go.
At least two dozen high-level staffers have quit or been fired during the president's time in the Oval Office, six in the last month alone. Weijia Jiang, CBS News, the White House.
An unusual confirmation from the White House Wednesday about arbitration. Press Secretary Sarah Sanders says Mr. Trump's lawyers won against a porn star suing him. At the White House with more is CBS News correspondent Mola Lenghi.
The lawyer for adult film star Stormy Daniels says she is suing President Trump because she wants to set the record straight.
She wants to be heard, and she wants to tell the public the true facts of what happened here.
Daniels, whose real name is Stephanie Clifford, claims in the lawsuit that she had an intimate relationship with Mr. Trump in 2006 and 2007. She signed a non-disclosure agreement in the days before the 2016 election, preventing her from talking about the alleged relationship. But she claims the agreement is legally null and void because Mr. Trump did not personally sign it.
Mr. Trump was obligated to sign the agreements in order for them to be legally binding.
The lawsuit says Mr. Trump used the alias David Dennison for the non-disclosure agreement and that a consultant firm was created to process payments to Daniels as a way to further insulate Mr. Trump. Last month, the president's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, claimed he paid the actress $130,000 out of his own funds and that neither the Trump Organization nor the Trump campaign was party to the transaction. Daniels' attorney told CBS this morning his client is not looking to profit from selling her story, but does not know if she will ultimately seek payment. Mola Lenghi, CBS News, the White House.
Some wicked weather stranded drivers in parts of New Jersey and across the Northeast, with some parts dealing with up to 2 feet of snow Thursday. Correspondent Meg Oliver reports.
Hundreds of cars and trucks were stuck for hours on highways as the second nor'easter in less than a week slammed the region. Emergency crews used snowmobiles to shuttle people to safety. Wet, heavy snow toppled trees and power lines, causing several fires. Almost a million people began the day without electricity, including more than 100,000 in Connecticut.
There are people without power. We understand that that's not optimal, and we're working with the utilities and watching the utilities in their recovery efforts.
At least 2 feet of snow fell in parts of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Vermont.
I don't like snow. I hate it, but, you know, what can we do about it?
In Montclair, New Jersey, massive trees crashed to the ground, uprooting huge patches of the sidewalk.
Near Philadelphia, the women's basketball team at Northeastern University had to push their bus to get it out of the snow. Coastal areas were spared the heavy snow, but parts of East Haven, Connecticut are underwater, and so are residents of Duxbury, Massachusetts.
We love it here, but we think they could be better prepared as far as having a pump, something to bail people out so we don't have to go through this.
To make matters worse, forecasters are watching another storm that could threaten the region early next week. Meg Oliver, CBS News, Montclair, New Jersey.
In Maine, the storm and rough surf exposed a shipwreck more than 160 years old. Still to come, a Russian spy story playing out in real life? That's next on the Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Scotland Yard's investigating the attack on a former Russian spy and his daughter. Police say Sergei Skripal and his daughter, Yulia, were attacked with a nerve agent.
Arrested in Moscow for spying in 2004, he came to the UK 6 years later and settled down to an apparently quiet life in Salisbury. Until Sunday, when he and his daughter were attacked in broad daylight with a lethal chemical. It's a very risky way to try and kill somebody.
They probably didn't.
Jerry Smith is a former UN chemical weapons inspector.
Why go to all the trouble of using a nerve agent? There are very much simpler ways to kill someone.
It's not a covert assassination that's taking place here, and perhaps there are wider messaging issues that are taking place.
So somebody was trying to send a message. For example, it was a nerve agent that was used to kill North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's half-brother in a Malaysian airport last year. If the chemical used in Salisbury was military grade, says Smith, then probably a state, maybe Russia, was involved. But there is an outside chance a civilian chemist could make something equally lethal. Annie Machon is a former British intelligence officer.
The media and our politicians should not go stampeding towards, you know, it has to be Russia, it's always Russia. There are many, many other players.
So just one example, enemy agents from Skripal's own days as a spy who might have links to organized crime or even corrupt militaries. Elizabeth Palmer, CBS News, London.
A CBS News investigation finds childmine cobalt entering the global supply chain and possibly ending up in our electronics. Cobalt is a key ingredient in lithium-ion batteries, and 2 years ago, Amnesty International revealed an estimated 40,000 children are mining for it in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Ziki Swazi has never been to school. He has no idea how to read or write, but he is an expert in washing cobalt. My parents are dead, he told us, and I stay with my grandma.
So you need to make money for your granny?
Yes.
There are thousands more children like 11-year-old Ziki. Barely 10 years old, these kids lug heavy sacks of cobalt to be washed in rivers. And even those too young to work spend much of their day breathing in toxic fumes.
Officials make a great show of chasing children away, saying nobody under 18 is allowed to work here. But clearly that is not the case.
We asked these companies whether childmined cobalt is being used in their products. All acknowledge problems with the supply chain, but say they require their suppliers to follow responsible sourcing guidelines. But our investigation shows just how complicated it is to trace childmined cobalt. Leaving the mine, sacks were already mixed up without labels.
The children's cobalt is brought here to this market, where it is bought by a Chinese company for extremely low prices.
Our team went back later with a hidden camera to see if buyers checked for childmined cobalt. When we offered to sell a truckload of the mineral, nobody asked us who mined the cobalt. This man told us that the Chinese traders here bought all the cobalt and sold it mainly to Congo Dongfang Mining, owned by global Chinese giant Huayu. Huayu said they no longer buy from that market and have a detailed program to eliminate child labor from their supply chain. But for children like Ziki Swazi, nothing has changed. Every evening he returns home clutching the dollar or two he has earned at the mine.
Before you go to sleep, that moment before you fall asleep, what do you think about?
My soul.
School, he answers simply, just a dream for this child. Deborah Patter, CBS News, Democratic Republic of Congo.
New video of an attack in Niger that killed four U.S. soldiers in October has surfaced. More from correspondent David Martin at the Pentagon.
A helmet camera worn by one of the American soldiers recorded the ambush. 11 American and 30 Nigerian soldiers were returning from what was supposed to have been a low-risk patrol. After the shooting stopped, the camera was taken off his body and released as part of an ISIS propaganda video. The Americans tried to take cover behind their unarmored SUV. With one of the soldiers at the wheel, they ran alongside, attempting to escape the kill zone. They fired colored smoke, which would provide some concealment and identify their position to any friendly aircraft overhead.
The patrol was overwhelmed very quickly.
One of them went down. Another rushed to his side and dragged him back to the cover of the SUV. Their position at the SUV was about to be overrun, so they did the only thing they could, ran to a position that might provide better cover. Except for the smoke from the grenades and a few scrub trees, there was no cover and no escape. The soldier wearing the helmet camera went down. Soon the camera stopped moving, and some of the enemy fighters came into view. Then a final blast filled the frame from what apparently was a round fired at point-blank range.
A military investigation finds the team didn't get required senior command approval for the risky mission to capture a high-level Islamic State militant. A new front is opening in the conflict in Syria.
Throughout Syria's seven-year war, Afrin was untouched, but not anymore. Since January, Turkey has been targeting the ethnic Kurds who live here with airstrikes and shelling. It sees the Kurdish forces as a terrorist group on their border.
This man just came up to me and started
crying and pointing to the sky and motioning about airstrikes.
While Afrin is Kurdish-held, it's Syrian territory, so President Bashar al-Assad sent in fighters to support them. Yet another twist to this war, that means Syria is allied with the very same Kurdish forces who've been armed and trained by the U.S. in the battle against ISIS. Thousands of civilians have fled surrounding villages in the last 2 months. Seth Doan, CBS News, Afrin, Syria.
A top Vatican official back in court in Australia, charged with child sex abuse.
He's the Pope's top financial advisor. Cardinal George Pell has been granted leave to appear at a court in Melbourne to face historic sexual abuse charges, which the Cardinal has already denied. It's a month-long committal hearing where a judge will decide if there's enough evidence to take the case to trial. The court's expected to hear testimony from 50 witnesses, all of whom have previously received ongoing support from strangers.
I take my hat off to all the people who ended up in mental institutions, in jail, or in a life of crime, and we stand up for these people.
A lot of feelings, and if anything, to be in support of the complainants who often don't get a lot of support.
Proceedings are closed to the public and the media, but there's already been a setback for prosecutors following the death of a key witness, resulting in his previous testimony being disallowed, and police investigators being accused of mishandling the case, with the Cardinal's defence team accusing officers of going after their client simply because he was a big name. The hearing continues. Scott Maiman for CBS News, Brisbane, Australia.
Up next, the newest development in the fight over sanctuary cities on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
If you like this podcast, check out what other podcasts are available from CBS News Radio.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Every week, an extended conversation at a restaurant in our nation's capital with newsmakers like
the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt.
Climate's changing. We contribute to it. I've said that 1,000 times, okay?
Chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez.
That's what this president has always been about. He divides people.
Samantha Bee, our very special guest.
I think I just realized my voice is really boring on podcasts. I'm sorry, everyone.
Not at all. Subscribe now for a new podcast every Friday morning. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. California did not roll out the welcome mat for Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who announced there the Justice Department is suing the state for its so-called sanctuary city laws.
Protesters in Sacramento greeted Attorney General Jeff Sessions with chants.
No justice, no peace.
To let him know that immigrants are welcome in California.
Federal law is the supreme law of the land.
Inside, Sessions addressed a crowd of local law enforcement and said California's sanctuary city laws undermine federal law. He singled out Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf for informing the public about recent immigration raids. And he claimed letting 800 undocumented immigrants get away.
How dare you needlessly endanger the lives of our law enforcement officers to promote a radical open borders agenda.
But the Oakland mayor fired right back.
How dare you vilify members of our community by trying to frighten the American public into thinking that all undocumented residents are dangerous criminals?
The Justice Department's lawsuit is the latest in an escalating feud between the Trump administration and California, which has resisted the president on marijuana policies, climate change, and immigration.
I'd like to see Washington building bridges. Not walls.
California Governor Jerry Brown called the suit a political stunt.
It's vicious rhetoric of an administration that wants to divide America and hold on to power.
That fight could go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. California will argue that enforcing immigration law is a federal responsibility, that California's duty is to protect the rights of all its residents, no matter how they got here. John Blackstone, CBS News, San Francisco.
Students returned to schools Wednesday after teachers ended a 9-day strike in West Virginia.
after securing a pay raise.
Heralding the 5% pay raise for striking West Virginia teachers and other state workers, Republican Governor Jim Justice says it's a new day for education in the Mountain State.
We will move forward. No more looking back. West Virginia renews its investment in education and our precious children today.
There were cheers, tears of joy, and applause as West Virginia lawmakers acted to end a 9-day classroom walkout, the longest in state history, giving some of the lowest paid teachers in the nation a sizable raise. Jim Crisula, CBS News.
Meanwhile, mutiny among teachers in Oklahoma over low wages. Correspondent Omar Villafranca reports from Lincoln County, where schools switched to a 4-day schedule to make up for low pay.
Text features.
Text features.
Jelaine Watham teaches second grade at Bridge Creek Public School outside of Oklahoma City.
Raise
Although teachers in her state make some of the lowest wages in the country, she loves working a shortened 4-day school week.
How has your quality of life changed?
It has allowed that weekend time with my family, but I also really truly feel like it has made me a better teacher by being purposeful and looking at time management.
210 of the state's schools operate on a 4-day schedule. Many stay-at-home parents we spoke to in this community endorsed the shortened week.
It's just that extra day. You're like, I feel like I have a whole entire day with my kid.
We should not encourage this.
But State Superintendent of Instruction Joy Hoffmeister worries about the long-term impact on students.
We are losing valuable time to sustain momentum and grow. Just extending more minutes to the day is not actually the same as having more days in the calendar year.
Bridge Creek Superintendent David Morrow says his district cut down the school week to recruit teachers in 2016 amid a statewide teacher shortage due to low pay.
Can you get better teachers with that 4-day school week?
Several years ago when we were on the 5-day school week, and I had three openings at our elementary school and had 4 applicants. Same 3 openings now and you have 15 to 20 applicants.
The average teaching salary in Oklahoma is the lowest of its neighbors. Teachers in nearby Texas make nearly $7,000 more. Following recent strikes in West Virginia, Oklahoma teachers are now debating a strike of their own.
Teacher organizations plan to announce a walkout date, and one date they're throwing around is April 2nd. That date is important because that's the first day of statewide testing in Oklahoma. Teachers are asking the legislature for a $10,000 raise over the next 3 years. Omar Villafranca, CBS News, Lincoln County, Oklahoma.
Newly released body cam footage of a police encounter last summer in Asheville, North Carolina, has touched off outrage in the community and on social media. Now the FBI is investigating. CBS News correspondent Gary Nunn reports.
Two cops are seen tasering, choking, and beating Johnny Rush, a black man whom they accused of repeated jaywalking.
Don't look at me with your spitty blood face.
Yeah, well, girl, you've been hitting me in my face.
Officer Chris Hickman orders Rush.
Rush, put your hand behind your back.
He began to flee, and a short time later...
We'll get up and put you in a car, tough boy.
Multiple charges against Rush were eventually dropped. One of the cops has offered to resign, so has the police chief. Gary Nunn, CBS News.
Newly released documents show the FBI paid Best Buy employees to report child porn found on customers' computers. Now privacy advocates are responding.
The documents show the FBI paid at least one Best Buy employee $500, apparently for reporting child pornography discovered on a customer's laptop. Aaron Mackey, an attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, says that amounts to warrantless searches.
We're very concerned about FBI using Geek Squad employees to get a backdoor around our Fourth Amendment rights.
Best Buy released a statement saying it has a moral and legal obligation to report any indecent material, but it prohibits employees from looking for anything other than what is necessary to fix computers. Matt Bigler for CBS News in Silicon Valley.
New research on how work can affect your health and productivity.
You ever lose sleep over work?
All the time.
Every night.
Every night?
Every night.
The pressures of the job have many workers staying up with worry. A new survey from AccountTemps finds 15% of professionals lose sleep because of work stress very often, while 29% say it happens somewhat often. And men are more likely to be affected than women.
Is it bad enough to turn your hair gray?
No, just losing my hair. That's about it.
The major reasons people stay up, they're overwhelmed with the amount of work they have to do. can't get a problem out of their head, or they're worried about strained relationships with coworkers.
Just worrying about the future, especially interpersonal conflicts at work can make you lose sleep.
That's going to impact your health. It's going to impact your productivity. So you need to find some balance there.
Bill Driscoll from AccountEmp says if you can't find that balance, it may be time to make some changes.
Are you in the right line of work? Are you overwhelmed? Do you need to talk to your boss about your current level of responsibility?
Phyllis Platon found the problem went away when she quit working.
I'm a newly retired person, so I now have the freedom of sleeping better.
Of course, there are people that don't let work get to them at all.
Ever stayed up worried about work?
Nah, not really.
No?
I got an easy job.
According to the study, 13% of us never lose sleep thinking about our jobs. Lou Young, CBS News, New York.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, we talk to former Democratic presidential nominee Martin O'Malley about his future.
I'm keeping an open heart and an open mind to running again in 2020.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio. And I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Martin O'Malley isn't ruling out another run for president. He was a Democratic candidate in 2016 after serving as Maryland's governor and the mayor of Baltimore. My colleague Bill Rakoff talked with O'Malley about violence in cities like Baltimore and his own future.
Governor, we met years ago when you were that big city mayor, and I was covering you in Baltimore at the time. And we were talking about crime on the streets. The city of Baltimore, the homicide rate, the violent crime rate has ebbed and flowed over the years. It spiked again this past year, and they've had another change of leadership at the top of the police department. Where do you think the city of Baltimore is in terms of moving forward past a lot of the challenges it's had with gun violence?
Beginning in 2000 and all the way through till 2009, Baltimore led the major cities of the United States in the rate of reduction of crime. We saw what had worked in other cities, notably New York, and we employed that in Baltimore, but we did something else at the same time. We promised, and in fact we did take actions, to better police our own police, to better supervise our police, to better train our police, and when necessary, yes, to better discipline our police. Mm-hmm. And we had to own that, and we did, and we took disciplinary actions, because the bottom line is, look, you cannot sustain reductions in crime unless you're also willing to tend to police integrity issues. And a lot of that stuff fell away in Baltimore beginning in 2012. And we need to remember that there's a balance to progress that's required, and you have to keep public trust in the center of the equation.
On a personal level, is it disappointing to see where the police
absolutely.
And what they've had to go through?
It's heartbreaking. The for 10 years... against the cultural baggage, the cultural predisposition that we had as a city to assume that there wasn't anything we could do about crime, we managed to persuade one another to believe that actually we could, that there wasn't anything about this fight that other cities weren't figuring out, and that there were things we could learn from other cities.
Where's your head at these days in terms of 2020 and your plans?
I'm keeping an open heart and an open mind to running again in 2020. But really what my energies are focused on is helping good people who are running in special elections all across the country. And I have repurposed my own leadership pack and efforts to win back your state. So this is one of those rare years where you have 36 governor's races and 36 state legislatures up. So sometimes great republics make bad mistakes. I believe that's what we did in electing Donald Trump. But good people correct them quickly, and I believe that's what the American people are going to do when they have their voices heard in these critically important midterms. So that's where I'm putting my energies.
If asked, would you do it?
If asked, would I do it?
Would
what
you
is
run?
This, the if nominated? Will I? Yeah. Look, it was a great honor to have run in 2016. I couldn't not have tried, given my sense that of what was going to happen in the general. And I'm very proud of what we put forward. But sometimes timing is everything in politics.
Yeah.
And the mood of the nation in 2016 was a pretty angry mood. Anger, retribution, rage. It was like we wanted to, you know, sick the dog on our national politicians. Anybody who had ever been in office was suspect. The Russians were certainly driving the theme that all your politicians are corrupt, and the more successful candidates that year were the ones who picked up that theme. So, but that's not what I'm about. I don't believe that anger and rage and retribution ever gave our kids a better shot at a better life. So I'm keeping an open heart and an open mind to it. Having done it once, I have a better appreciation for what it takes. And I do believe that you're seeing a big shift in the public mood. Americans don't like crazy. They don't like extremism. And they don't like mean, and they don't like cruel. And so I think better days are coming.
Correspondent Bill Rakoff talking with former Maryland Governor and Baltimore City Mayor Martin O'Malley. So-called farmer bro Martin Shkreli was sentenced to prison for 7 years Friday for securities fraud, but he could have faced up to 20 years behind bars. He became infamous for raising the price of a life-saving drug by 5,000%. Ben Braffman is Shkreli's attorney, who had pushed for an 18-month sentence.
This is a good judge who I think spent a great deal of time trying to examine the facts and all of the letters that were written on behalf of Mr. Shkreli, and she made her decision, and we all have to live with it.
In letters to CBS News, Shkreli expressed little remorse, but during his sentencing hearing, he apologized to the New York judge and promised reform. A report from a government watchdog slams the leadership of the VA for waste and a climate of complacency at its Washington hospital. Here's correspondent Jen Crawford.
This, to me, represents a failure of the VA system at every level.
Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin says he only learned of the systemic issues at the Washington, D.C. VA hospital about a year ago when an interim report revealed problems with sterile equipment and unused inventory. The full report released Wednesday revealed staggering deficiencies. Patients who underwent prolonged anesthesia because surgical instruments were unavailable once they were put under. Doctors and nurses forced to make do by borrowing supplies from a nearby hospital, while 500,000 items sat unused in a warehouse. And the government renting items like 3 home hospital beds for nearly $875,000 that would have cost only $21,000 to buy.
I think it was a failure of leadership here.
Inspector General Michael Missel says while no patient died as a result of the safety issues, patients were put at risk, and senior leaders didn't take responsibility before the problems got worse.
We talked to everybody, and everybody pointed their finger elsewhere.
Secretary Shulkin announced changes to senior leadership at nearly 24 hospitals across the country. He also says the VA has appointed 24 new facility directors at low-performing hospitals over the last year.
The D.C. VA Medical Center has come a long way.
American Legion Executive Director Verna Jones is treated at the hospital herself and has met with Shulkin. She said the report is, quote, concerning, but the VA is improving.
I believe that now things are getting better and that Dr. Shulkin and his team are addressing the root of the problem.
In November, we asked Shulkin why it's taken so long to address problems at the VA.
We're not declaring the problems of the VA over. We have a lot of work to do.
Jan Crawford, CBS News, Washington.
The insurance industry is consolidating a bit more. More from correspondent Steve Kathan.
Health insurance giant Cigna is spending $52 billion to buy the pharmacy benefits manager Express Scripts. Add in $15 billion in debt, and it's a $67 billion deal, close to what CVS said it would spend to buy the insurer Aetna late last year. Analysts say these big deals are important if the industry intends to rein in soaring prices for prescription drugs and other health care costs. Cigna had been the target of a failed takeover by Anthem Blue Cross, with each side accusing the other of sabotaging the deal. Steve Kathan, CBS News.
Coming up, tracing a presidential pedigree on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS News Radio app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up. It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, Weekend Roundup, or the CBS Evening News.
And good evening. Wall Street today signaled its approval of the tax cuts passed by the Republican-controlled Congress.
You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS News Radio app for iOS or Android. Download it today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. The brutal murder of a celebrity hairstylist is the focus of a 48 hours investigation this weekend. Correspondent Michelle Miller probes the death of Fabio Cementilli. Michelle, first tell us about Fabio, who he was.
Well, Fabio was this larger-than-life hairdresser. And about 5 years ago, Wella, that beauty giant, the hair giant Wella, tapped him to move to Los Angeles and to become one of their senior executives. He moved out there. Things seemed to be going fabulously. His wife, his children seemed to have finally gotten their house in order in terms of feeling as though they were part of that community. You know, it's a high celebrity, high energy town. Then suddenly, one afternoon in January last year, he was stabbed to death while he was smoking a cigar out by his pool. Who did this? Well, that's the question.
And there are a few twists in this case.
Well, there are a lot of twists because at the time of Fabio's murder, there were these burglaries, high-profile burglaries that were going on at the time. They called them the knock-knock burglars, and these were gangs from around Southern California who were essentially hitting high-profile people. So the initial suspicion was that these knock-knock burglars were possibly the suspects. What they didn't realize was, man, there was so much more to this story.
There is a lot to this story, and you can watch it Saturday night on 48 Hours on CBS TV or stream it anytime on CBS All Access. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
A look back at a successful Oscars last weekend. Here's correspondent Danielle Nottingham.
After last year's mix-up, Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway returned to announce the Best Picture winner. And this time, there was no mishap.
The Shape of Water.
The Shape of Water took home four awards, including Best Director for Guillermo del Toro.
Growing up in Mexico, I thought this could never happen.
Get Out's Jordan Peele lost to del Toro in the Best Director category, but he became the first African-American to win for Best Original Screenplay. He said he hopes his win inspires others.
I almost didn't do it because I didn't believe that there was a place for me.
Female empowerment was a major theme of the ceremony. Three of Harvey Weinstein's female accusers took the stage together to highlight the Me Too movement.
Time's up.
And Frances McDormand, who won Best Actress for Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, called on all the female nominees to stand with her.
We actually started a conversation that will change something.
The Oscars addressed other political issues as well.
Tell the NRA. They in God's way.
Common rapped about the NRA and the Parkland shooting, and actors Lupita Nyong'o and Kumail Nanjiani spoke of being immigrants.
We are dreamers.
Gary Oldman took home Best Actor for transforming into Winston Churchill for Darkest Hour, and Sam Rockwell and Allison Janney won in the supporting category. Danielle Nottingham, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Prince Harry and Meghan Markle celebrated International Women's Day Thursday as they prepare to wed.
Well-wishers waving British flags lined the streets of Birmingham to catch a glimpse of the country's current it couple, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle.
She's kind. She's magical.
The pair stopped by an event that celebrated International Women's Day, encouraging girls to break down stereotypes by pursuing jobs in science, technology, engineering, and math.
They're very kind, and considering their royalty, they treat you normally. They wouldn't expect you to bow down to them or something.
The couple also visited a wellness center that trains teens and young adults to become sports coaches and mentors.
For them to take out of their time to come and talk to us all means a lot.
Birmingham is the fifth British city Harry and Meghan have toured ahead of their May 19th nuptials at Windsor Castle.
In preparation for their wedding here, Markle was reportedly baptized this week into the Church of England in a private London ceremony led by the Archbishop of Canterbury.
The former actress's debut tour appears to be wowing the masses. Prince Harry pulled this schoolgirl named Sophie out of the crowd to meet Markle after the 10-year-old told him she wanted to be an actress too.
In a new poll, Brits find Markle one of the most relatable royals, or royal-in-waiting, second only to Prince Harry. And while not everyone's impressed, most seem captivated by this fairy tale romance. Terry Okita, CBS News, Windsor.
And finally this weekend, tracing an American presidential pedigree.
Hi, Mr. Tyler.
89-year-old Harrison Ruffin Tyler is the grandson of U.S. President John Tyler, who was born in 1790. Yes, you heard that right. Just three generations, President Tyler, his son Lion Tyler, and grandson Harrison span almost the entire history of the United States.
But I'm still here.
We met Harrison and his son William at President Tyler's Virginia estate.
When you tell people that you are the great-grandson and your father is the grandson of the 10th president of the United States, do they find it hard to believe?
I find it hard to believe. I think it has to do with second wives.
Much younger second wives. Here's how it happened. John Tyler became president in 1841. He had eight children with his first wife, who died while he was in office. At 52, he married 22-year-old Julia Gardner. They had seven children for a total of 15, the most of any president. He was 63 when son Lion Tyler was born, whose first wife also died. Lion, too, had a very young second wife. He was 75 when Harrison Tyler was born. Yeah, President Tyler renovated this house, Sherwood Forest Plantation, with young Julia in mind.
This was the ballroom. John Tyler's wife was 30 years his younger, and she liked to party.
Liked to party.
Yeah, and this was designed for the Virginia Reel.
Which was all the rage at the time. William says the house is haunted.
That is the ghost. And it's amazing. You can see the curls coming down and a bonnet on top of her head. It's clearly a young girl, there's no doubt.
The ghostly image remained even after being painted over. President Tyler's biggest accomplishment was the annexation of Texas, but political ambition does not run in the family.
You never thought of running for president yourself?
No.
You wouldn't want that job?
No.
Would you want that job?
No. I know better.
Instead of making history, they prefer to preserve it. Chip Reed, CBS News, Charles City, Virginia.
That does it for the weekend roundup. Thanks for listening. The show is always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com and let us know where and how you're listening. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Mitchell Fallon is our intern. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.